Welcome to Linux Matters, a podcast featuring three experienced open source professionals as we discuss the impact Linux has on our daily lives. This is episode 30, and I'm Martin, and in this episode, I'm going to be telling you about my project QuickEMU that quickly creates and runs optimized virtual machines of Windows, macOS, and Linux.
Hi, I'm Mark, and I'll be talking about getting notifications from my servers on my phone.
Hello, I'm Alan. I'm going to talk to you about my job.
I wanted to talk formally about QuickEMU, a project of mine.
Formally?
Yeah. Well, we've kind of touched on it. Mark's mentioned it in a couple of episodes, things that he was doing. I've mentioned it in passing. It's sort of a thing that we've kind of alluded to, and I'm a little bit proud of it. The project's had a bit of a mini reboot recently, and I thought I'd talk about why it's been rebooted, what's changed, and sort of what it does, for those of you that don't know, because I think this is a useful utility. It's not quite the Q in the A to Z of modern Linux, but maybe one day it will be.
Not with that attitude, it isn't.
This project started because it's all Alan's fault, I seem to remember.
You're welcome.
Usually is.
Back in the heady days of 2018, when Alan and I were working at Canonical, we were doing lots of testing of snaps on lots of different distributions. And in order to rapidly do all of that testing, we put together a shonky shell script that basically knew how to download, set up, and create a bunch of VMs. And I think that initial version was maybe using VirtualBox behind the scenes and not QEMU, but we created this thing to sort of automate a bunch of like Linux distro testing. And after I left Canonical, I kind of took that shonky shell script and made it more shonky and decided to release it on the internet. And today, QuickEMU is a wrapper around QEMU that can run as an unprivileged user, so you don't need libvirtd or any of that stuff. And this is true to sort of the origins of what Alan and I were doing way back when, because what we both had was a USB drive chock full of virtual machines that we wanted to take with us and not consume all of the disk space on our laptops.
I'd forgotten about that part. Yeah, I remember it was VirtualBox because I had a Symlink on my laptop,
right,
for the two folders that VirtualBox needed. There was a VirtualBox VMs in the home directory and then a something buried in .config or somewhere. And those two folders sat on a gigantic USB attached hard drive, well, gigantic compared to my laptop.
Right.
And that's where all the VMs were. And we would, yeah, test stuff out. Gosh, memories.
Yeah. So this was why this thing came into existence, because it was that being able to run it just as a regular user, no super user permissions required. Anyway, I've been working on this on and off for about 4 years, and it's a tool that's broken down into two parts. The imaginatively named QuickGet and then QuickEMU itself. And what QuickGet does is it's an automation tool to download the distribution of your choice automatically and then create a virtual machine configuration for you. And it requires zero knowledge of how to actually build a PC or what a virtual machine is or how to create one. So it inspects your RAM, CPU, GPU, and a bunch of other system capabilities, and automatically builds a virtual machine configuration that does the best that your computer can do.
So creating the config is done by QuickGet, not by, yes, QuickEMU.
Correct.
So it kind of does two things. It goes and gets the ISO or whatever the media is, and then creates a configuration file, right?
Yeah.
And I know you've mentioned libvirt, and I am 100% certain people are shouting, just use libvirt or known boxes or one of these other million other things that can do virtualization. But you didn't.
Correct.
And I'm quite glad you didn't. But I don't know why you didn't, but I'm quite glad you didn't. Because I've never had success with any of those other tools at all. But I've had super success with QuickGet and QuickEMU.
Well, that's delightful to hear. And apparently so have 10,000 other people, according to my GitHub metrics.
They all send you emails, did they?
I get love letters occasionally, yes.
Nice.
But one of the other things which I think meant that there was quite a lot of noise about it when this was first publicly released was that you managed to make it do Windows 11 and Mac OS X, as well as all of the Linux distributions. And particularly this was when there was a lot of fuss about how Windows 11 needed a TPM on your laptop, so it wouldn't work with old laptops.
That's right, yeah.
But then you managed to do something with a software TPM instead.
Yeah, so while automating a virtual machine configuration for running a Linux on Linux is relatively straightforward, the real sort of magic quality of QuickGet is the fact that it can do this automated download and configuration of a virtual machine running macOS or Windows. So it knows how to pretend to be the macOS recovery agent and download a recovery image and then create a virtual machine that can boot the macOS recovery image so that you can install it. And for Windows, it will be able to download either Windows 10 or 11 in multiple languages, but it also creates an unattended ISO image with the SPICE drivers and the VertIO drivers all baked into a Slipstream driver bundle. And it will do a Windows install, again, completely unattended. So it will take you all the way through installing Windows without you actually having to do anything. So this is sort of the magic that QuickEMU and QuickGet have for those foreign operating systems.
Yeah, I don't care about that. I just use it for Linux.
So it's interesting because actually the macOS bit, I mean, it's very difficult to do and it's a little bit janky. So, you know, your success may vary. But for the Windows side of things, I myself and I have seen other people use it because QuickEMU can do the whole USB pass-through stuff. Mm-hmm. I use it to do firmware updates on devices using Windows inside a VM, connecting USB devices through the USB pass-through. So I find it particularly useful for that. So my game controller I have here in front of me, I updated the firmware using a VM of Windows 11, and similarly other devices that I have, I've done the same over the years as well.
So you wanted to talk about it because it's had a bit of a resurgence and a reboot. What's going on?
Yeah, so I talked about Lima quite recently, and I was sort of hinting that maybe, you know, Lima was the way forward for me and I would sideline QuickEMU. Well, I've decided that was a bad decision on that podcast, and that's not what I want to do. Mostly because QuickEMU is really, really good at testing like Ubuntu releases, which was sort of one of the origins of QuickEMU when I rebooted that script. So I recently shared QuickEMU with the other Ubuntu flavor leads to say, hey, this is a really great way to test your upcoming release because it knows how to keep the daily live image in sync and it sidesteps some compatibility issues that you see with VirtualBox. And for sort of those reasons, and also the TPM stuff that Mark alluded to, and the fact that it does a good job of hardware acceleration for GL and stuff like that, I was like, for desktop testing and distro hopping without having to hop distros, it's a really useful tool. And I've decided to give it some polish. So as of today, it currently supports 98 distinct operating systems. And that matrix of releases and editions is very close to 1,000 different OSs. And that had been one of the reasons why I was thinking about like parking the project, because how do you validate all of that? Well, it turns out GitHub is how you validate all of that. So one of the things that's in this new release, which is of little value to end users, but immeasurably valuable to me, is it can now test that all of those ISO images are accessible and available, and it knows that all of those download links are current and working, and it tests all of that in CI. And so we've given the whole project a fresh coat of paint. We've reorganized the documentation.
Still written in Bash?
It's still a Bash script, but it's interesting you ask that because I have interesting news on that front. So we're about to release 4.9.3. So as you listen to this podcast, that will be available. We'll have a link to the project in the show notes and you can download the deb and all of that good stuff or get the binaries. But as for Bash, one of the contributors to the project is a Rust developer.
Uh-oh.
And they have worked on a re-implementation of QuickGet and QuickEMU in Rust. And I can exclusively reveal that although it's early days, one of the features of the Rust rewrite is that you can download and boot and run virtual machines for foreign architectures. So you can run ARM ISO images of your favorite distribution on x86 or vice versa.
Oh, nice.
So this is one of the reasons why I decided to stick with the project, because I think we're at a tipping point with ARM becoming more popular, just generally. And I think having a tool available to help build and test ARM software on non-ARM devices will be of value going forwards.
One of the things with running ARM stuff in VMs on x86, well, there's two things I'll mention. One, dog slow. And two, some people want to perfectly emulate specific SBCs like Raspberry Pi. And there are certain twiddly flags and settings and all kinds of stuff for QEMU. Do you think you're going to do board specific ARM support or just generic an ARM image with no board support?
It's definitely possible. For example, we can control that we know that the image you're about to download with Quick Get is for a Raspberry Pi 4 or a Raspberry Pi 5. So we have the ability to bake the smarts into the VM configuration that it creates to be have all the tunables enabled to mimic that hardware as best as possible. So
nice.
I think it's tractable. I mean, it's challenging, but it's interesting, right? It'll be good fun trying it out.
No, that sounds fun. Yeah. I can never remember all those settings. So yeah, I'm looking forward to trying this out once the Rust support lands. As you hear this, I am about a month or so into a new job at a company called Ancor. And gosh, it's been a learning curve. As we record this today, I took part in a webinar, which was a bit of a product announcement and a change in functionality that we wanted to talk to the customers about for the paid product, the enterprise product. But also we did a little announcement of some open source tools that we've been working on. And I found this super interesting and super fascinating because Ancor does a lot of stuff with open source and develops a bunch of open source tools and also has this enterprise product that's built on top of these open source tools. So, you know, the enterprise stuff pays the bills and the open source stuff is just super cool and groovy and rather excellent.
So although Alan and I don't work at the same company, we do work in the same location. And I was very excited to hear that Alan was joining Ancor because I'm a fan of their products.
Ah, speaking of which, so actually, before I started at the company, I'd never heard of them and I'd never heard of the products before I started interviewing because I don't work in the sector. So Ancor make a bunch of security products, shall we say, in inverted commas. And so probably the most well-known are SIFT and GRIPE. That's SYFT and GRYPE. They're both fully open source, available on GitHub. You can grab the source code and build it yourself, or you can download binaries, and they're available in Brew and for Mac, and they're available as packages everywhere. And they're really all about getting a bill of materials of your software, is what SIFT does. So you can point SIFT at, for example, a Docker container, and it will give you a list of all the things that it thinks are inside that Docker container. And then you can use tools like GRIPE to figure out if there are any known vulnerabilities in any of the things that are inside that container. And then there are other tools as well, but those are the two main ones that people seem to enjoy using, SIFT and GRIPE. And it was quite a learning exercise for me because I'd never used either of these tools. In fact, I'd never heard of them before last year because I just didn't work in the field. And so I spent a bit of time in my onboarding going through some training stuff and talking to everyone in the company and understanding what everyone does, but also using the things and figuring out how they work. And that was, as an outsider coming in and having never tried the tools before, it was quite refreshing and enlightening for me. Because like when I started at Canonical, I already knew Ubuntu inside out. And so I joined knowing the products, most of the products anyway, the secret ones that I didn't know about until I joined. But with Ancor, I just didn't know. So I was a fresh pair of eyes. And that is great in a couple of ways. I've spent a lot of time over the last few weeks learning about this stuff and trying stuff out and figuring out how it all fits together. And in fact, before I started, I was trying the stuff out and some of it had bugs. And I discovered bugs in the software just through, you know, grabbing the source code and building it and doing things that the developers probably haven't done for a while because they're working on a machine that's, you know, they've been building the software over and over again and they know the process. And, you know, your muscle memory means that you do the same commands. Whereas I just read a GitHub readme and like an idiot, I blindly follow the instructions that are on the readme, expecting them to be correct. And sometimes there's bugs in them and it could just be a missing package or a, you know, one line change here or there. But I found it quite good fun to file issues before I even started at the company. And then in a meeting today where we were going through issues that were outstanding, someone pointed at one and said, oh, I'm working on this one. I went, oh, that's mine. I filed that. So yeah, it's been really good fun.
At least they didn't assign you your own issue to fix.
No, I think that would have been a bit of a stretch in the first month. Yeah, especially as we all know, I'm not a developer. Yes.
So my favourite of the two is Gripe, which is the ability to scan either a file system or a container for a vulnerability report. But it does way more than you would expect from that sort of brief description.
Yeah, I quite like the fact that it like spits out the list of, you know, all these CVEs. And, you know, that's not the end of the story. You still then have to go and do some research and figure out if these are actually CVEs that you are vulnerable to and whether you care about these things or not. It's only part of the story, right?
Yeah.
There's also another tool that I haven't mentioned called Grant, which is also interesting in that it scans like a container or whatever, or a repository full of stuff and tells you all the licenses that all the software is distributed under. And so it can give you a big list of all those licenses and you can even set exclusions and say, we don't allow this particular license. So if you're the kind of organization that don't want to touch GPL3, for example, where some corporations don't, you can explicitly say that. So when you scan containers that are going through the pipeline of your development process, you can say, nope, not touching that one because it's got GPL3 code in it, or we're not touching that specific package in that repository, or we should be wary how we handle this particular container or something. It can affect the way you handle the software that's going through your organization.
And can that also link up with SIFT? If you've got a bill of materials, can you use Grant to check that your licenses are, for example, you are using open source stuff and you haven't accidentally stolen someone's proprietary code in there?
So the interesting thing is some of the metadata that it relies on, you know, it's having to rely on accurate metadata in the first place. And so, you know, sometimes people lie on the internet and
what?
Yeah, I know. But yeah, in general, you can say, I don't want to mix this and that license, you know, for whatever reason, legal compliance or whatever. But yeah, I really found that super fascinating because it was just opened my eyes to a bunch of tools that I'd never used before. The other thing that it opened my eyes to was I now have a work laptop, which is a Mac. And I was quite pleasantly surprised to get a laptop that I didn't explicitly specify. You know, for a long time now, I've been at companies where I can choose my own device. Whereas this was, here's your laptop. It was basically handed to me. I was like, oh, okay, fair enough. And I thought, everyone uses a Mac. They must all love Macs. But then you chat to engineers, just like at any organization, when you chat to engineers, and, you know, some love it and some would prefer a Linux machine. And so I wouldn't be surprised if at some point some of the engineers get Linux machines. But at the moment, that's what I've got. But I found it super interesting because I haven't used a Mac for work ever. I've never had a, you know, that as my full-time computer. And so it was quite a voyage of discovery dealing with software management and Brew and PyPy and all the other stuff that you have to install. It was quite a challenge getting used to some of that while also learning a bunch of software that I'd never used before. So that was all like my first couple of weeks was like intense learning stuff. But the webinar that we did today was about another set of tools that they've created. And this was another part of the whole security world that I just wasn't aware of. I knew that CVEs existed and I knew that CVEs are a way of describing, you know, it's a number allocated to a vulnerability that's been discovered by a software vendor or a vulnerability researcher or something, right? But I didn't realize there was this extra metadata on a CVE that's added by an organization called NIST, which is a US federal organization, and they maintain a thing called NVD, this database. And the day after I started, the VP of security in the organization was like, hey, we need to have a chat. And it was like an hour of, you need to learn about this thing. I was like, okay. And so I'm furiously taking notes. And it turns out that for some reason, NIST have stopped what they call enriching this database of security information, the NVD, with metadata. And there's various discussions online as to why they might have done this. Maybe they've not got enough funding, or the people have left, or they're just choosing a different way to do it because the workload is so high. We don't really know. And so Anchor decided to create a project to create some of that data enrichment, the metadata that normally would come from NVD, and put it in an open source GitHub repository. And so that's one of the things we were announcing in this webinar today, was an open source project that we're inviting other people to help us maintain, because the output data, which is the CVEs plus some enriched data that details, you know, affected packages and that kind of stuff, we want other people to help us maintain that. And so that was what we were talking about. And that was another extra thing that I wasn't aware that was a thing until like a month ago.
This was really interesting when you were telling me about this, because it was one of those sort of weird, like, convergence of a casual conversation with being immediately affected by it a few days later at work. Because I've been using Gripe to scan container images for vulnerabilities for some time, back when I worked at Slim. And in fact, Slim integrated Gripe into the platform to do vulnerability analysis. And at work, we build our container images with Nix, and every week we have a security review. And one of the products of our security review is all of our container images that have been composed get passed through Gripe, and Gripe rather marvelously can actually scan Nix built container images. And we look through that and do vulnerability analysis. And a few weeks ago, where we would normally see a CVSS2 score, it suddenly started unknown. And it was like, oh, this is awkward. And then Alan explained to me over coffee one morning what was going on. And now I know this open source initiative exists. We do a lot of, well, we do a weekly security review. So I can totally see us contributing to this to provide enrichment data for NixOS related stuff. It's not everything NixOS, but it is the NixOS stuff that we're using.
Yeah. It's still in bootstrap mode, this project, because it was done in kind of a rush, because suddenly there's missing metadata in the CVEs. Now, the thing that Anchor aren't doing is doing the scoring, because that's a subjective thing that the vulnerability analysts at NVD were doing. And there is an impact there, in that some federal organizations are mandated that they have to deal with certain scored CVEs in a certain timescale. And we don't want to be the ones who say, this is a high priority, you know, you, the Navy, or you, the, you know, Ministry of Defense, or whoever it is, need to adhere to this, because we're not responsible for that. That's not our bag. But adding the metadata that says this package is affected and this version is affected, that kind of stuff, we can certainly add. So yeah, it's all super fascinating and quite a learning curve, and quite enjoying it.
What's the new open source place where all of this metadata lives called?
I'll put a link in the show notes. It's got a long, unfriendly name. It's like NVD vulnerability data or something, but it's all under the Anchor GitHub repo.
Cool.
And so one of my tasks is to make stuff easier to find and make the readmes a bit more pretty, because that's, you know, that's easy. That's not code. I can do that. And so I want to make it all easier for people to find and get involved with, because at the moment it's like a thrown together bunch of scripts that we had to do rather hurriedly to insert data into this feed that was missing, because our customers rely on it and other people rely on it. So I'll put a link in the show notes, and if anyone wants to come and take a look and you're interested, or you know any security researchers who might be interested in this stuff, then send them a link.
Now I've got my new servers set up and talking to each other and power management going on, I wanted them to be able to tell me things. Because in the old days, I used to sit around with my laptop open all the time and have an SSH session going, and there'd be a status bar at the bottom of my Yobu window, which would tell me what's going on my server. But I don't really have that anymore. I've got my laptop when I need it, but my phone is my main device that I have available all the time. So I wanted my servers to be able to tell me things to my phone. And I tried a few ways of doing this in the various things that go on, mostly sending me emails, which I open my email client on my phone for it to tell me that it's done a backup last night and here's all the things I backed up. But that's not like a nice push notification responsive when things are going on. I've also got KDE Connect on my phone, which I can use to, you know, push things between laptops and my phone and other phones. But using KDE Connect on a server isn't particularly trivial. There are a couple of options, but none of them particularly slick. But then I looked into a project called NTFY, which I'm going to pronounce as Notify, which is something that I've been aware of for a few years. I once built myself a smart doorbell. It wasn't that smart. But the way it worked is that it was connected to a Raspberry Pi, and when someone pushed the doorbell, it sent me a message with Notify. But back then, Notify relied on third-party messaging systems to do its transport. So it would actually use a Telegram bot to send me a message in Telegram, which had latency and wasn't great when you actually need to go answer the door before the person wanders off. But I was pleasantly surprised to look again at Notify and find that it's basically completely changed since then. It's now got its own PubSub server with a really nice REST API. And what that means is that you can have the Notify CLI, you know, NTFY, send message, blah, 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 blah. And you know, you get some nice syntactic sugar with that. But because it's a REST API, you can actually just use curl or any other
nice
thing that can send an HTTP request from anywhere. And it can send to either the public Notify server, which is at ntfy.sh/your channel name, which you can create on the fly. Or you can host your own server if you want to do stuff internally, which is what I've done.
If you post to the public one, which reduces the amount of infrastructure you have to run.
Yes.
Does that mean like I could subscribe to your channel and I could get notified when things happen on your server?
Exactly.
Oh.
If you're just using the free open service, then yes, it's all public stuff. It's encrypted over HTTPS for the transport. But yeah, anyone else could subscribe to your messages. Which, yeah, actually might be a useful thing in some scenarios if you wanted to be pushing messages in a public scenario, but not for what I want, where, you know, I'm not necessarily pushing sensitive information about my servers, but there might be some interesting things in there for people. You can pay for a Notify Pro or whatever they call it, in which case you can have private channels as well. And you can, you know, you can come up with random channel names for a bit of security by obscurity if you want that sort of thing.
So you said you wanted notifications of things
yes.
from your server to your phone, and you mentioned Telegram earlier. Is this like a Telegram pusher, or does it support other endpoints and protocols?
No, so this is just its own thing now, as far as I can see.
So do you have like a Notify client on your
yes.
phone?
Ah.
Yes. So when you run the server, you also get a web app at the server's address if you open it in your browser, and that will show you all the channels that you've subscribed to on that server. But yeah, there's also an Android app, which by default you can say ntfy.sh/channel, or you can say here is my server and you can subscribe to channels on there.
So how do you notify and monitor Notify on your infrastructure at home?
What?
Who notifies the notifier?
Yeah.
That is sort of covered in what I'm notifying about.
Okay.
So the few things that I've got it telling me are when I'm doing my clever wake on LAN thing, a few times it's fallen over because the servers that's being woken up didn't shut down properly last time. So now what I have it doing is it will send me a notify from the server sending the wake on LAN event saying I'm waking up the other server. And then the server that's being woken up will send a message to say I'm awake. And then it'll do whatever it does, which a couple of things it does there are R clone backups and RAID scrubbing. And then at the end of that, it will send me a notify message with a little summary of what happened. And then when it goes to sleep on its schedule, it will send me a message saying, I'm going to sleep.
So I could use this rather than my current process, which is having a cron tab on my server, which has mail2@alan@popey.com.
Yes.
And me getting a flood of emails every time there's a backup run and whatever else is in the cron jobs. I could instead have notifies in each of the things if things don't work.
Yeah.
And then just keep an eye on the things that don't work, for example.
Yeah.
Nice.
As long as the thing that sends you the notify works.
Of course.
Then yes, you could do that.
Of course.
The other thing that I've got is, so this is what I was saying about notifying about notify, when my Docker containers refresh, so I've got a script which basically refreshes everything in my Docker Compose file, it then sends me the output of Docker PS, which shows everything that's running or fell over as a result of being refreshed. So if I don't get that one when I expect to each week, then yes. Or I can see if other services have failed to come back. And similarly with snaps as well, because a few things running on my server are snaps. So I've scheduled when snap refresh runs to a particular point, and then an hour after that, I have it tell me what snap refresh last did, so I can see what updated that week.
So that reminds me of, I've got a script that runs that updates a page on my website that lists all the snaps I have published and the versions that are in the snap store and the versions that are upstream. And I check that web page periodically like an idiot. And what I could do is have, when that script finishes, all the ones that are not up to date just ping me a notification. Yep. So every day I'd get a few notifications of things that need updating. Obviously, what I should do is just automate all of that and make them build and then publish and then notify me when they're built and published. Yes, that's right. But I like this. I like this a lot.
You can also have it give you like buttons in your notifications which run scripts as well.
Oh,
if you have things that you want to happen in response.
Wow, this is fabulous. I totally need this.
Mm.
I hate getting notifications via email. My email is just spam and system alerts, and it's a useless means of communicating with humans. So I love the idea that I can have a means of notifying me about the status of my stuff in a siloed place.
If you're not on Android, what do you do for the Notify app?
I am on Android, so I haven't looked any further. There's a good chance there's also an iOS app.
I will investigate that.
If not, there's a web app.
Mm-hmm.
You just go to whichever Notify server you're using in your browser, and I think it'll do web notifications as well.